and roll. I got Brian DeLucia on the Capital Razor Show. Welcome, my friend. How you doing, brother?
Oh, excellent. Glad to be on here, Ruben.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Yeah. We've been chatting it up for a couple of years. I've been asking you to come on the show for quite some time to break down what it is family offices before I even knew. And now I'm working with Richard Wilson, who he's powering the show with his company Pitch Deck. So I'm really excited to be working with him. Why don't we start with this, man? For the people that haven't heard of Brian, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this thing we call real estate syndication and other commercial real estate assets.
Absolutely. So I came out of a family background with uncles, family, friends that basically had been working together going back to the 1970s in a few different companies. And land development turned out to be our primary economic driver, along with building development as well, but developed over 15,000 residential lots over the last two generations, as well as building several thousand units of real estate. And, you know, been in and out of some other non-real estate, I guess you would say, old economy endeavors over the years. And that led to where we're at today. We're mostly middle-aged next gens over here who are, I would say, remaining very pragmatic and focused on where the marketplace is today. We leverage our deep domain expertise and still very heavy in real estate and other hard assets like cell towers and fiber and occasional operating company. And then I've parlayed a lot of our experiences from a family office perspective, as well as a industry domain perspective, to playing a board role with five other families as well.
So at what point along the way did you start to understand what a family office was? This a new concept, or was this something that you knew about the entire time? Because it sounds like you were raised into this real estate business.
You know, I said, yeah, certainly a generation ago, you weren't around, sitting around thinking the word family office, or, you know, you're working and seeing everybody just have their heads down every day, shovels in the ground and just executing and building. But I would say definitely over the last 15 years or so, there's been a couple liquidity events, and then you look at things much differently in terms of transitioning to a much different level of not only just generating revenue, but then managing large balance sheets and wealth moving forward, which is a little bit of a different mentality than, let's say, 20, 30 years ago, when you're constantly only thinking about day-to-day growth, building things up. Now, today, it's a combination. You have to think about a lot of things with estate governance and having a very defensive profile as well. So yeah, definitely the mind shift, I guess you'd say, adjusts over time, and you try to maintain a good balance yet between growth and still remaining very defensive at the same time.
Amazing. All right. So let's talk a little bit about your business model, because we're stepping into development ourselves, getting into this built to rent space, going and finding and acquiring land, and then putting in the entitlements, doing the civil engineering, getting it approved with the city, and then going out and raising capital to take down these suckers and eventually sell these entire subdivisions off to institutions. Right. Or keep them, or sell them off to individual retail buyers. We have a lot of different exit strategies along the way. And at the end, we can do a bunch of different exit strategies as well. What is it that you do? You mentioned 15,000 lots. Are you building the vertical part or just the horizontal part? Tell me about your business model.
Yeah, that in the past, we did a combination of both. There was large scale, just raw land development, basically creating subdivisions for the major builders, and then transitioning over the years into larger tract, single family, multifamily, some suburban office and retail development. Most of that is actually a pretty good portion that is still held yet today. So that's just asset managed. And then over the last couple of years, did a complete CapEx throughout that portfolio. But today's focus is really strictly buying around zone and entitled land, essentially shovel ready development sites, and then overseeing ground up vertical development. And it's a product that is townhouse and a cottage style multifamily type of community with Class A amenities and walking trails, dog parks, and And we just leverage our domain expertise to the hilt in terms of understanding how to control a budget, maintaining wider margins, and just being very risk adjusted, I think, especially for the environment we're heading into now today. When we set up our current strategies, we actually set them up for a rising rate environment. As a result, we're really set up very well as a, you know, as a good hedge against inflation.
So what are you doing with these cottages and townhomes once you build them? Are you selling them? Are you keeping them? Combination of both?
It's been a combination of both. In recent years, certainly we've had some offers that were too good to turn down. However, especially with where the environment is, as I said, I think our projects are probably one of the rare sources of yield in the marketplace for at least the next few years. The plan overwhelmingly will be to hold these for the long term with no definite exit strategy in mind.
Have you lived through a couple of real estate cycles, or would you say that you're working on the first one, second one?
No, absolutely. I said, you know, we've been through a few of these cycles over the years. And obviously the last one was during the banking crisis. We had some opportunistic scenarios that hit and landed on our desk, fortunately, that we capitalized on. But every cycle, and this certainly has a little, some different characteristics compared to, let's say, 2007, 2008, 2009.
Very cool. So what I remember about 2008, I'm from Phoenix. I live in Phoenix. And there was new apartment buildings, luxury apartment buildings, or even four-story garden style Victorian multifamily communities being built. And then when the crash happened, all of a sudden these buildings stopped being built and they sat there unbuilt for like 6-7 years, maybe not quite that long, but it was a good period of time before they came back and got finished. Do you have any concern with building now that this type of thing would happen again? Obviously, the lending scenario and situation is very different in today's environment, where people aren't, banks aren't just lending to anybody that has a pulse. But do you fear anything about construction? Tell me about your confidence level in construction over the next number of years.
Yeah, there's definitely some differences. And you kind of reiterate one of the thoughts I said, the last downturn that we had was created by just a lot of what I would call just ridiculous money out there. I call it fog a mirror type of money. You fog a mirror, you get a mortgage. So that definitely fueled quite a bit of the last crisis and ultimately dried up the credit markets. Even consumers back then had, I think the average credit score for a consumer was like in 680, perhaps. Today, a little bit of a different market. The banks are certainly in a much more stable position liquidity-wise. Consumers are certainly more stable credit-wise right now. There's going to be some softening of that for sure over the next several months. But overall, in general, there's certainly much more stability among consumers. Private capital is readily available. Demand, I believe, is still going to remain fairly strong. I mean, we have substantial shortages yet in housing units across many communities. So I definitely believe that we should be able to navigate through that. Where the challenges are going to be, and a lot of this, that's why I don't like to throw a blanket on things and say everybody's doomed, or where I see a couple of the challenges for, let's say, a development perspective, if you put leverage on your land before you went vertical, and you may have a land loan coming due. Now with some of the changes in cost and supplies and so forth like that, with inflation and everything, interest rates certainly higher, your project might not pencil out to get a construction loan, or your project may not pencil out to secure an LP partner. So you're going to have certainly some disruptions there, where I believe that's going to open up some opportunities for us to acquire maybe some broken development opportunities over the next few years. And then also with one of the families that I sit on the board with, looking at a lot of private credit opportunities as well. So I do believe you're going to see some disruptions there. The other situation is folks that acquired multifamily value add assets the last few years, especially more recently as well. I felt our ground up projects have been better risk adjusted than buying existing just the last few years, because everybody's been acquiring essentially with very little margin for error, riding these tailwinds of very aggressive rent growth. And in exchange for that, they've been accepting kind of middling economics. And while I don't believe the bottom is going to fall out like it did on assets 15 years ago, I do believe that investors are not going to realize nearly the returns that they were expecting on paper. Because like I said, I believe a lot of those assets were acquired for very, very little margin of error.
Interesting. So I remember back in 2008, there was, at least in Phoenix, can't speak for the rest of the country, but we actually had an oversupply of houses. They were just going up like hotcakes. Yes. And then all of a sudden when the crash happened, so did the building. And It just barely over the last few years, they're starting to catch up, but They didn't build for like 10 years, not at a very high level. So there's this massive shortage of housing. The price of real estate is going up, and now it's going to be like a nation full of renters for the next number of years because they can't afford a mortgage anymore. Yeah. So it's been a little bit of craziness in that perspective.
Do you
see that this development space is going to be great because there is such a shortage of housing and because people can't afford houses, so they're going to rent from you and other people?
Oh, absolutely. Just like any other industry, supply demand is critical, and there's an absolute demand that I don't believe is going to slow down a whole lot during the next few years. And also, I believe just due to the type of product and type of community that we build, you kind of get the benefits of both. You have the benefits of feeling like you're living in a home, and you also have the benefits of you feel like you live in a real community as well, with a lot of the Class A type of amenities. So I do believe that the type of communities that we build, many of them that also include some retail components and some other commercial components as well, should make these attractive communities to continue living in. And so I certainly believe that the opportunities will be very appealing for families essentially across the country.
Tell us about the different markets where you like to invest.
Right now, it's really going throughout the southeastern states, a little bit of Virginia, because it's a home base with one of our family members. Also, the Carolinas, parts of Georgia, like the Atlanta and Savannah suburbs. Alabama has a couple of really attractive suburbs like Huntsville and Birmingham. Tennessee as well has a few attractive areas. Chattanooga is a very underrated market. Florida, we love the central part of the state, and even going from the Atlantic side, you're starting to see a lot of activity now up a little bit further up the coast. But then you go through like Gainesville, Central Florida, Ocala, over to like Brandon, Tampa, and on down the Gulf side, you have really good bang for your dollar in terms of your land costs going in and so forth compared to other parts of the state. Yes. And then you go over into Texas, and the demand just continues to be incredibly strong there. There's just large swaths of land that are available. We have a lot of knowledge of that market as well. So very, very attractive. And then we still look at up north with one branch of our family. We're originate from a lot of family members in the southeastern Pennsylvania. And we look at a lot of infill opportunities, like, can we build 25, 35 townhomes on this site? Or is there a potential main on main or corner commercial lot that we could redevelop into a healing pad site moving forward? So simple things like that. There's not those widespread, large tracts of land. There was a generation ago since like folks like us ended up acquiring and building large communities on those. So most of you have to be a lot more creative today when that market to find development opportunities.
Ryan, so what's your role in the whole thing? What is it that you do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, my day is very flexible because I handle a lot of macro level leadership throughout the day. I could be dealing with a estate situation, anything on the governance side. Business wise, I could be speaking with a land developer 1.5 hour on a potential land acquisition, to where I'll just pass that along then to our business development and in-house broker. But I generally know enough within a few minutes. I have a pretty good idea if it's something that's going to align with us. And I'm always on the phone with boutique advisors who may have a good, let's just say a manufacturing company that founders reach an inflection point. Other times I'm on the phone with, you know, attorneys, since we do a lot of M&A business, a lot of real estate business, usually a good candidate to, at least I guess you'd say, a reliable resource if one of their clients needs some assistance, either a positive event-driven situation or a challenge, or somebody's looking to take chips off the table or whatever the situation may be. So my days certainly do vary quite a bit between in-person meetings and phone calls. I believe being very engaged within the marketplace, within communities, I like to have my feet on the ground and gathering a lot of intel and just making a lot of really good, genuine connection points throughout community. So you're really aligned and in touch with what's really happening out there.
In your process of scaling and growing your family real estate business, are you ever looking to partner with other family offices or anybody like that? Or are you trying to grow internally just based off of the profits that you're making?
We do not have a fund. We don't go soliciting any capital anywhere. We do have, just through natural, I think, dialogue throughout the years, we certainly do have, let's say, other families. And this has been happening for generations now. This isn't anything new or revolutionary in the marketplace, like I think some folks tend to make it out to be. But naturally, you have a lot of ultra high net worth circles you belong to. So we all chat, exchange notes, swap stories, and so forth. So, you know, there's always those opportunities that come about where they say, we'd be interested in maybe doing something together with you. Or like we have large friends that are at large institutions or we manage a lot of capital as well. And, you know, the word is out there in the grapevine that we're out there doing, and it's, you know, a little bit different. So we certainly do have folks that will reach out to us. And now that I think there's going to be a lot of compression in the market the next couple of years, and I think we're probably one of the rare sources of yield out there and actual yield that's well risk adjusted, I'm sure. And we are seeing it that, you know, folks are reaching out to us because we are probably one of the rare sources of yield right now.
So talk to us a little bit about family offices. Mm-hmm. When you're out there networking with these different groups, I mean, just over time, naturally, you kind of have conversations. My experience is that a lot of family offices maybe have a portion of their portfolio in real estate and they're invested in a bunch of other things. Yeah. What are you seeing? Do you ever come across some family offices that are completely out of real estate and others that are completely 100% in real estate? What do you think the average is, if there even is such a thing?
It's a great topic that you bring up because there's so many different shapes and sizes when it comes to family offices or just ultra high net worth families in general, or vetted family offices as well within operating companies and at the same time. And yeah, it's interesting because there are some families that's all they're involved in is real estate is like 100% of their focus. They may have a little bit of for wealth management or some, you know, of course, or from some estate purposes, they may have a little bit set aside somewhere else, but primarily their investment dollars are in real estate. And certainly there are most traditional heavy real estate families, I would say that is more likely the case. Others that are non-real estate families, I mean, they may have zero in real estate because they just don't understand it, or they're intimidated by it or whatever, because it's, you know, it's a illiquid, can be a scary asset for folks if they don't have any domain expertise in it. And then there's others that maybe they have like 25% of their portfolios in real estate, where 10% of it is, and they just have a couple cash flowing assets, or maybe they're just invested into a REIT or a fund manager just to have some exposure to real estate. So it's just really all shapes and sizes, comfort level. And as a family, you have certain mission values and areas of domain expertise. And also at the same time, it comes down to size and your internal staff. If you're maybe just a very small and inclusive family that it's just a couple family members that overseeing the day-to-day operations of vetting out transactions and asset management and the whole nine yards, you're probably going to be a little bit limited maybe in terms of what you have in real estate versus if you're maybe a little bit more of an institutional infrastructure, or if you have a dedicated CEO that you brought in from the outside. And there could be some differences in terms of just how you might approach the market from a direct versus, let's just say, aligning some dollars into a manager.
All right. So one more topic before we jump into the lightning round. I'm curious about, from your perspective, when would it make sense for a family office, based off of what you've seen over many years, when would it make sense for them to invest with a scaling syndicator, somebody that maybe either has 500 apartment units or has developed and built 500 townhomes or houses or cottages or something like that?
I said, you want to see, like I said, they're looking at an operator who's syndicating capital. You want to align your dollars with an operator has really deep domain in the local market. So you want to look at somebody like, for example, if they live in Kansas City or something like that, you don't want to see them like, you know, okay, I got a property in Salt Lake City. I have a property in Cleveland. I have one in Charlotte. You really want somebody that is very ingrained and really understands their market. You want somebody that has a very good demonstrable track record. You can see that they executed from start to exit on a couple assets, or at least, you know, at least two or three exits that you'd like to see. And so you're looking for operational capability and alignment of interest as well, in terms of how much capital do they have on their balance sheet and their portfolio. It's just like we're looking, and this is a non-real estate example, we're looking at a portfolio company in another industry more recently here. And it was a gentleman who was a CEO of an institutional group in his industry vertical. And he went out on his own about 2 years ago and set up a portfolio company, made several acquisitions in his vertical, but he put $4 million of his own cash on the balance sheet. And that's meaningful, you know, and that still sits on the balance sheet today. There has to be alignment of interest there between both parties as well. And then you just, I think from a values perspective, philosophically, but even like I said, from a values perspective, is there alignment of interest there? Are you comfortable with them as people? What's their personal lives like? I mean, if I'm going to be investing into a manager or syndicator, I want to make sure that they have a stable personal life and notable distractions happening in their life that might be diverting their attention or anything along those lines. So a lot of little things like that, that you really have to get to know somebody over some time, and also just see how they're meeting their benchmarks. Because like as a family office, you might take about 12 to 18 months to get to know somebody before you invest a dollar with them, because you want to see, like I said, in different settings, how are they interacting? How are they responding to things? Are they meeting their benchmarks? Like if they told you when you first met with them like 6 months ago, and they gave you these projections like of here's where we're going to be, here's what we're in the middle of working on right now, and what we're going to accomplish. You want to make sure that they end up actually accomplishing those things. So you want to get that comfort level there. So a lot of those items, I believe, are very, very important that add up into making the right decision, because we all look at, let's just say 100, I always said it's 100 proposals at any given period of time to align with maybe one or two folks. And that's the reality of it. And I mean, that's why there's a lot of little things that you're always looking for in a group's thesis, you know, their people, their personalities, and how they execute and how they've handled challenging moments. So it's a lot of key pieces to the puzzle.
To the audience that's listening in, I want to reemphasize one of the things that you mentioned, which is maybe out of 100 particular partners that you could get, you might end up doing business with one. Because I get a lot of people who are just like, oh, I can't find a partner. And I ask them, well, how many people have you talked to? They're like, well, 12. Yeah. I'm like, no, you got to talk. It's the same ratio as real estate. You probably got to find and locate 100 deals in order to just take down one. Same thing with partners. So keep that in mind, guys.
Absolutely. And if you're like, if, for example, if you're a real estate syndicator, you're probably started out raising capital through the retail investor channels, high net worth folks in your communities, high income professionals. I've never done that myself, so I can't speak for experience, but I know from having a lot of conversations over the years that it's very stressful. It's very time consuming. And you get to inflection points with that for sure. But most times that's where folks will do want to transition and say, I hope we could just find one LP partner for our transactions moving forward. And it is challenging because you have to understand you're competing against a very large number of other syndicators, operators as well, because I often have folks that reach out to me and they'll say, hey, Brian, we're buying this asset. I know it wouldn't be for you guys. Who do you know that you can maybe introduce us to or chat with about what we're doing? And honestly, a lot of times on a multifamily value add deal, I said, I'll look at what they're doing. And it's basically the profile of their transaction. It's not a bad, it's actually a quality transaction. But like when I think about some of my friends who are LPs in multifamily value add, they have like at any given moment, they may have at least minimum 10 to 15 of those same transactions on their desk right now. So adding number, let's say 16 to that, probably isn't going to do anybody any good, whether it's either side of the table. So I think it's always important to have a little bit of a unique but still fundamentally sound thesis, be able to demonstrate that you have access to intel and a grasp on domain experience that, let's say, a minimum amount of people, have, and then being able to take that intel, convert it into a business model that generates revenue. And then I believe really most importantly from there is understanding how to create the proper alignment of interest or a compelling alignment of interest with a family office or a private equity investor. And that's one of the more, I think, underrated things that folks miss out on is, they don't understand or grasp the concept of alignment of interest between both parties, because ultimately in many transactions, the one party is going to be essentially taking, it could be 95, it could be 90, it could be 85% of the equity exposure or equity risk in the transaction. So there needs to be some aligned interest with that in mind when you're thinking about the economics and what you're proposing to especially a family office.
Amazing content. Very cool stuff. All right, let's jump into the lightning round. Let's start with this question. What's your favorite vacation that you have ever taken?
I love Martha's Vineyard. To be honest with you, it's a little bit more relaxing, very quaint, old school. I love the New England states, just the vibe of it. So I would say that's like my favorite.
Fascinating. What's your favorite childhood memory?
I was playing Little League baseball. So I think this was a Sunday afternoon. I actually hit, and this still, I probably is still a record to this day. This is like probably 30 something years ago now, but I hit a baseball. There's another field behind it actually. So I hit a baseball, the left center field, that actually ended up landing and enrolling to the first baseline of the other field. By the time that they ran the ball down, they were picking up the ball as I was touching home plate. So that was probably one of my favorite childhood memories. And actually back in my hometown, once in a while, I'll see somebody that was like playing in that game or whatever that will actually bring that up yet. So that was a fun moment.
How awesome. How long do you want to live?
As long as I have quality of life and I'm adding to the community, I enjoy bringing value out there and just being a productive member of society. So I don't even think about the alternative.
Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
No, I mean, I'm just very fundamentally sound as an individual. I believe in just doing the right thing for folks, whether that's in business leadership or if you're in a marriage, or you're running a business, or you're a political leader, I think your decisions need to be guided on what's the right thing to do for our folks.
Can you tell me about a moment that impacted the trajectory of your life?
I wouldn't say that there was any one. I think it's just honestly a series of things, that events over the years or experiences that just continue to elevate you or continue to evolve you over time. And I'm one of those folks that believe that, you know, you're constantly getting better and improving, and you know, we all have a next level. And I also believe as we get older, we also start realizing what's really important and what's not really important in the grand scheme of things. And there's some things that you might soften up on a little bit that you were a little maybe too hard line on when you were a little younger, because you realize in the grand scheme of things, this isn't really that important. So yeah, it's just honestly a constant evolving of things.
Sure. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
I was very close to getting hit by a car when I was like a teenager. Fortunately, somebody looked out for me, but that would probably be the closest thing.
All right, last question, brought to you by Shanna Amiga, one of our great listeners of the show. She would like to know, what kind of impact would you like to leave in the world?
You just leave it better than you found it every day. I mean, it's everything that I do on a day-to-day basis is all about just helping to create better places for people to live and work, or being involved in endeavors that are creating better quality of life, helping to build up good entities that create more long-term sustained jobs and, you know, certainly better economics that stabilizing people, families, and the community. So it's just all about just simply leaving it better than you found it.
Great stuff on the lightning round. Thanks for entertaining us on that part of the show. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions, my company, and our sponsors, Good Ag Investment, Syndication Pro, Caitlin Patel, Jerome Myers, and PitchDex.com. So if you want to check out more information about our sponsors, go to the CapitalRaiserShow.com website. Brian, how does the audience get a hold of you?
Well, they could certainly look me up on LinkedIn or I believe Twitter, and feel free to reach out on our website as well at arivatollc.com. Look me up and reach out. Always happy to engage with folks out there.
I'll put it in the show notes. One last question before we leave. Do you have any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser and or syndicator or developer as they're scaling in their business?
My best advice is, don't worry about what other people are doing. Play your game. It's on your timeline. A lot of people panic. Actually, just last evening, I was talking to a very talented lady. She's been around a long time and told me, you know, just struggling to raise capital. And the same thing I just told her, I said, we're all on our own timeline. The most important thing every day is put in your reps with consistency. So on the micro, you always want to be consistent, putting in your reps, and on the macro, it's just going to happen on when it's meant to happen on your timeline, but you have to put in the repetitions every day. I think that's the most important thing that I would say, and just stay true to your personality, focus on emotional intelligence. And I think as long as you incorporate those few principles in play, I said, things will happen in your timeline.
A lot of amazing information in this interview, guys. That was fantastic. Brian, really appreciate you coming on, man.
Thank you.